ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
How reliable is your memory of a crime scene? And can those memories be manipulated?
Connected to wrongful convictions?
How a memory works can be damaging for a justice system and for the integrity of a justice system.
This is Sana Qadar from All in the Mind. If you are a fan of true crime, you should check out our new series, Forensic. It's about the quirks and curiosities of our weird human brains. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
As leaders of two of the world's great superpowers prepare to meet.
It feels like the world is watching a game of chess.
Kind of weird game of chess. Right now, one player seems to have the upper hand.
President Trump will meet Xi Jinping in Beijing, hoping to make a deal.
That's all on the next episode of Deal or No Deal. Sorry, Global Roaming. Global Roaming. I'm Hamish McDonald.
And I'm Waleed Ali. Welcome to Deal or Global. Welcome to Global Roaming.
Well, Waleed, you know, always trying to weave a bit of that commercial television stuff of yours into the ABC.
Oh, you'd know nothing about it, Hamish. Nothing at all. Yeah.
We've got quite a week ahead of us. Trump has a timeline here that Beijing doesn't have. Trump's got the midterm elections ahead. He's got the situation in Iran and the Strait of Hormuz. There's lots of pressures that I think, to my mind anyway, and not that my logic should necessarily apply or be applied to the Trump administration, but lots of pressures that I think would incentivize making a meeting like this happen for a whole cast of reasons, which I'm sure we'll get to.
Yeah. And while you're at it, will the Reserve Bank lift interest rates next month? No, I think that analysis is actually right, but doesn't it show how different the meeting is now?
Oh.
Because if you imagine the world of the original meeting, there was no war in Iran. The war in Iran would either, in Trump's mind, have been over in a matter of days, as I think he expected, depending on the reporting you've been reading, or it just wouldn't happen at all. He goes in, this is very much a trade conversation, isn't it? You know, there's been so much back and forth over tariffs. The Supreme Court got involved. That's been the dominant thing, and that's been a huge thing for us in Australia. Now, the war casts a pall over the whole thing. The question it raises in my mind is, does that just make Xi the dominant figure here, the one who can call so many more shots than Trump?
I spent the weekend thinking about this because I reckon that is sort of, I think the obvious answer to that is yes. It's clear that Iran is a strategic blunder for the United States at this point because of the way it's playing out and the way in which Iran has been able to extract so much from the United States just by, you know, punishing the global economy and the energy markets, in the sense that it's gone on so much longer than he would have anticipated or wanted. But this conflict in Iran is not without its challenges for China, right? So it is China's closest relationship in the Middle East. It gets the bulk of its oil from Iran, or at least via the Strait of Hormuz. It also, complicated for Beijing, it also has very strong relationship with the UAE. So two sides of this conflict, if you like. And so I don't think it's as simple as to say that there's no downside of this conflict for China. And don't forget that just last week, Abbas Araghchi, the Iranian foreign minister, was in Beijing meeting with Wang Yi, the foreign minister. So I suspect they are certainly thinking about the need to bring this to a close. But I suppose from a trade point of view, like there are unbelievable numbers, given everything that is happening in Iran. Actually, in April, China's exports and imports set monthly records. So the trade surplus for China in April, so that's exports over imports, was $84.8 billion. And even with the Iran conflict raging, they're on track for a $1 trillion trade surplus this year. And of course, Trump hates that.
So it's clear that Beijing has an interest in the war being resolved in some way and the strait reopened. That is clear. It is also clear, though, that its interests are not similarly shaped to, say, Australia's interests or Europe's interests, and perhaps even America's interests, because, you know, it has other ways of getting Iranian oil, and the Iranians have been, at least until very recently, allowing Chinese ships through to get to China. But the other big thing about this, and in some ways what we watch anytime we have a US China interaction, or especially a Trump China interaction, is a total clash in philosophies with respect to, say, the time horizons that they have in mind when they make their plans. China has been preparing for something of this kind for a long time. It's built up its oil reserves in enormous ways. It thinks so long term in the way that it does this.
Well, it's easier to do when you don't have democratic processes and you can just set the five-year plan and roll it out.
That's right. But if you are Donald Trump and your art is the deal, so to speak, and those deals are short term, you kind of end up speaking a bit of a different language, it seems. And the leverage that you might have in mind, because your leverage is predicated on what can be done in the short term on a particular issue, just doesn't necessarily match the leverage that a China would have that is thinking in 5, 10, 15, 50-year time horizons. That's why I think these meetings are so fascinating. And when you throw in the upheaval that the Iran war has unleashed, they become hugely unpredictable. And so what Donald Trump might have wanted to get out of this meeting, I'm not going to say it won't even come up, but it seems it has to be further down the agenda than it otherwise would have been.
The big difference between that last meeting and now is that Trump now has something that he really would like to get China's help on, and that's the Strait of Hormuz and making sure that that is resolved in some way that becomes functional. And look, maybe it is too simple to boil this meeting down to those two agenda items, because of course all the trade stuff is real and does matter. Soybeans, Boeing aircraft, you know, tariffs, tech, all the rest of it. But I do think that these two men will have one big thing in their mind. And for Trump, it's the Strait of Hormuz. And for Xi Jinping, it's probably ultimately in the longer term, Taiwan.
And Australia, meanwhile, might have one little thing in its mind. I don't mean that dismissively or derisively, but I mean literally with respect to size. And that is the Solomon Islands. Because, of course, the Solomon Islands is undergoing a little bit of political change as well. But it is making what for us is actually quite a huge strategic call about whether its lot is in the Chinese sphere of influence or what we call it, the Australian-US sphere of influence. We've been through this upheaval with Manessa Sogavare when he was prime minister, making quite clear overtures towards China and away from America. That landed in the middle of an election campaign. It was first time in ages. I remember foreign policy being an election campaign talking point and a controversy. And now it's going through this process again of figuring out new leadership. That's just another little wrinkle in this. And the role of the Solomons and its relationship or its relevance to us with our respect to our security in the region is just outsized for something for a nation so small.
Well, let's put some of this to Kirsty Needham, our guest on this episode. You might know her work from when she reported for the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age. She was their China correspondent. She then left and went to Reuters overseeing their China coverage. She's now the Australia Pacific correspondent for global news agency AFP.
Kirsty, welcome to Global Roaming.
Good to be here.
This is a big meeting for everyone, isn't it? For Australia, mummy and daddy are meeting and we're hoping they're not fighting. For Xi and Donald Trump, of course, they have their own sort of high stakes. Maybe we'll start with them. What is at stake for each of those respective leaders here?
This is a very important meeting. It's Donald Trump's first visit to Beijing since he was last president, 2017, but there's been no US president visit China on a state visit since then. When this visit was planned earlier this year, Trump thought he would be in a much stronger position. He'd be going there to talk about trade, to come back with some wins ahead of the midterm elections in the US in November. But now you have a war in Iran that's dragging on. So from what we've seen from US officials in recent days, Trump will be seeking China's help in putting pressure on Tehran to end this war. There was an AFP interview a few weeks ago where he said he thought Beijing had played a role in getting Iran to ceasefire talks. But that's likely to overshadow the very serious issues around trade and Taiwan that will also be on the table.
Kirsty, before you joined us, I was talking to Waleed about what's changed since these two leaders met in October last year. And the thing I keep coming back to is that the trade issues are the trade issues. Both sides have had things they've wanted from each other for quite some time. They've both had bugbears. The thing that's really changed in my mind is that she would have always gone into these meetings with US presidents seeking from the US some ground on the question of Taiwan, but they've always been able to kind of hold their status quo line on that. The difference this time around is the Strait of Hormuz. And I wonder if actually putting all the trade stuff to one side, this is actually for China going to be a meeting about, can we extract something on Taiwan in return for giving Trump a bit of what he wants on the Strait of Hormuz?
The US recognises Beijing as one China, but it's also always been committed to supplying Taiwan with arms to defend itself. She's likely to put pressure on the US over arms sales. A big package has just been agreed by the United States government and by Taiwan. US officials are saying that they're going to stand firm on their wording over Taiwan policy. And the US has a policy of deterrence in the Indo-Pacific. It doesn't want a conflict with China over Taiwan. But at the same time, the US missile stockpile has been dramatically depleted by what's happened in the Middle East. There's concern in this region that the US focus is distracted, that military assets are being moved over to Middle Eastern theatre. And so a question mark is, does this embolden China and Xi Jinping to bring forward what's seen as a timetable for reunifying? But at the same time, China has its own problems with its military. Last week, we saw two former defence ministers in China sentenced to suspended death sentences. This is unprecedented, and it continues a purge that's been going on in recent years by Xi Jinping of his top military generals. So that also puts another question mark over, despite the situation that the US military finds itself in, stretched, extended, whether or not China is in a position to take advantage of that. So all of these uncertainties and, you know, question marks are hanging over this meeting.
I suppose I always wonder the extent to which the West gets a bit too excited about things like military purges in China and interprets them as a sign of weakness going into a moment like this. Do you necessarily see that as a sign of weakness? Because there are those that say, look, Xi's just got total control.
And he does. He's the, you know, the commander-in-chief, the Central Military Commission, so the apparatus that, you know, sits above the People's Liberation Army. It did have six senior military officials on it with Xi. There's only another one now. And there's been, you know, China's military is a black box, trying to interpret from outside what's going on in Chinese politics and the Chinese military. It's a fool's errand. And, you know, as these purges have continued in recent years, there was uncertainty over what it had meant. Recently, there was a New York Times article over the weekend suggesting that perhaps one way to look at the continuing purges, if Xi Jinping had a deadline of his military to be ready by 2027 to achieve reunification, why would such high-level purges be continuing? And this article was suggesting that Xi prioritises the loyalty of the military over military success, which was a really interesting interpretation.
Let's just leave to one side for a moment, or anything that might be happening within the Chinese military. Is there a strategic reason China would say, no, we don't want to invade Taiwan now, even though all the conditions suggest that it's more favourable than it's perhaps ever been?
So China would only want to do this if it knew it could win. Unlike the United States, the Chinese military hasn't been involved in any major conflict for many, many decades. There's been an increasing tempo of Chinese military drills around Taiwan, an increasingly aggressive exercise posture. But Xi Jinping is someone who likes certainty, and the Chinese political system likes stability and certainty. So very the polar opposite to what we've seen with Trump launching a war in the Middle East, taking risks. That's not something that you would see from the Chinese political system.
This might be a wild thought, Kirsty, so just put me in my place if this is. Surely, if that's the way China thinks about it, you've described there what I would call a fairly rationally informed approach to its military escapades. It's not about what it wants to do or what it feels like doing. It's really about what it can rationally defend and think will succeed and the minimization of risk. Surely China, looking at Russia's ensnarement in the war in Ukraine that was, in Putin's mind, meant to only go for about a week. Then America's ensnarement in Iran. These are, you know, vastly more powerful military machines than those that they're invading. But nonetheless, here they are ensnared. If China looks at that and is waiting for the moment where it is assured victory, well, it seems that the nature of contemporary warfare, it's so asymmetric. That moment will never arrive. It's only getting harder and harder. Taiwan will have its porcupine defense and it'll fight back with drones and missiles and so on. That it means it won't beat China in a conventional war, but China won't beat it in the same way that we're seeing in Iran and in Ukraine. And if that's the case, the logical extension of that would be, well, China's not really going to invade Taiwan. The moment where it would be prepared to is getting further away, not closer. And if that's true, maybe this is getting wild, if that's true, maybe nations like the US and Australia and so on, building so much of their strategic thinking around China's potential invasion of Taiwan, are just basing it on totally the wrong thing, on something that is very unlikely to happen if all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle are the way you've described. Where in that analysis or that suggestion have I gone way wrong here?
Well, I think a key thing missing there is looking at China through the eyes of a Western or any other kind of political system, because the Chinese political system is highly organized, highly planned. It's very, very different. And one thing that I think watching Chinese governments, even before Xi Jinping's, China's president always does what he says he's going to do. The Chinese system, they flag very clearly. They have five-year plans setting out what they're going to do. And if Xi has said that they are going to achieve reunification with Taiwan, the most sensible thing to do is to believe that that's what they're going to set out to do. When we talk about asymmetric warfare, the rise of drones, hypersonic missiles, China has been, you know, charging ahead in developing these technologies. The naval buildup, China's naval buildup in the Indo-Pacific is the fastest in the world. So I don't think we can apply what we've seen with Russia extending itself on the war field with very, you know, yes, they've been using Iranian drones, but they've also been using the sheer massive population of Russian soldiers out in a very, you know, turn of the century style warfare. China is very, very different. It invests heavily in technology. It's building up its nuclear arsenal. So I don't think that parallel can be applied.
But I also wonder if this whole conversation misses the reality that maybe China is doing it already, that their version of invasion or taking Taiwan is more the kind of Hong Kong model. It's done more quietly. It's done through the political systems, through civil society. Certainly being in Taiwan last year and filming, the discussion was about grey zone tactics and the way mainland China and the PRC are kind of infiltrating or trying to infiltrate everything from what you watch on YouTube right through to who's elected to parliament and the way they land on policies in Taiwan. And, you know, I think we have to be alive to the fact that, yeah, maybe China is responding to Ukraine and what they're seeing in Iran and the asymmetrical nature of warfare, but they're just actually deploying those tactics themselves in a much cleverer and maybe quieter way.
What would Trump possibly have to offer? What would they want to get out of Trump if they've already got this subterranean strategy that might be actually quite effective and has been proven to be effective in Hong Kong? I mean, maybe Trump has less to negotiate with than it appears.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest trend that we see with US and China trade is each trying to insulate themselves from the other. So, you know, the US is trying to build up its rare earth supply chain, its chip self-sufficiency, so that if there were a war in, you know, over Taiwan, that it's not vulnerable. But this is the big question mark around the meeting. I mean, and the thing missing from whether or not Taiwan with its porcupine strategy could resist the Chinese attack, it's what the role of the US would be. Apart from just, you know, supplying arms for Taiwan to defend itself, what action would the US and its allies take at that moment, at which the US will never state? And this is what Xi would be trying to extract, some kind of language from Trump, backing away from a US role defending Taiwan. Trump is a volatile character. unlike the last time that he went to China where he had senior officials around him guiding on policy, it's Trump now that seems to make these decisions. He, you know, from past bilateral high-level meetings, he can make decisions quickly. He says things that are unscripted. So it's the volatility around such a sensitive dynamic on Taiwan that allies like Australia will be watching, Taiwan will be watching, and you know, where China, it will try to apply pressure.
We do tend to think of this as sort of geographically quite removed from us, this whole conversation, but there's some stuff going on in the Solomons right now, and I know that's an area you've looked at pretty closely, Kirsty, that is quite dramatic, but it's also really very closely linked to this interplay between China and the US and via its influence in the Pacific. So what's happening and how does it reflect or mirror the broader game?
Well, we've just seen a prime minister ousted on Friday in the Solomon Islands, and it's a very small Pacific island country, but it's really closely watched by China, by Washington, by Canberra, because of where it sits geographically, its history in World War II, that it was a key battleground as the US tried to come west towards Asia in that war. And it's seen as, if there was a conflict in the Indo-Pacific over Taiwan, that China having a presence in that area could be a big problem for the United States. Already, the Solomon Islands is China's closest security partner in the Pacific. It's not known who the next leader will be. An interesting point here is that the US under Biden put huge diplomatic importance on the Pacific. You had high-level meetings, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense coming into the Pacific, trying to wind back some of the Chinese influence that had started there decades ago with roads building, bridges being built, and was gradually being segued into a security presence that China wanted there. Under Trump, he came in last year. There was, I guess, upset in the Pacific as Trump announced new positions on climate change, announced that big aid departments would be cut. But in recent weeks, we've seen quiet diplomacy by the US in the Solomon Islands, in Papua New Guinea, Fiji, some of these crucial Pacific islands where the US is moving to shore up its security and defence ties. So that's why everyone's looking at the Solomons to see who comes along next.
Kirsty, thank you so much for joining us on Global Roaming today.
Great. Thanks for your time.
Well, that was Kirsty Needham, AFP journalist, correspondent formerly with Reuters and also the Sydney Morning Herald. So, well, the Solomons piece of this puzzle, pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. And for so many reasons, I think what we're witnessing in the Solomons, and this is just my inference from it. So, you know, there are other views available, of course. But I think what we're witnessing in the Solomons might be something more akin to a bidding war over who it gives its sovereignty to. And this is a very common thing that happens in Pacific Island nations because they don't have enough, you know, natural resources. The Solomons case, they don't really have tourism, anything like that. So they've got very little they can base their economy on. And so the question then becomes, well, okay, what we can sell is our sovereignty. It might be, you know, internet domain names, or it might be, you know, military agreements with bases or whatever it is. And we see that throughout the Pacific. And in the Solomon's case, I mean, ever since the switch, which was, you know, moving more towards Beijing, which is what, 2019 or something, I think what you're seeing is they're going, all right, there's China, that's a big dog, and that's got a lot of money to throw away if we trade our sovereignty. The US, that's another big one. Let's see who the highest bidder is. And I wonder if it's more that than it is anything ideological. And Australia, in the context of that bidding war, can only contribute so much, really. It becomes a US-China conversation, ultimately, I think.
I think it's really interesting because there's an argument, right, that when there is great power competition, and it's particularly great power competition between two powers, that middle powers actually can play the game quite well if they're able to find ways of playing the powers off against each other. And I think what we're seeing at the moment actually is these sort of micro nations, micro states almost, that are doing that more effectively. And it's the middle powers that are somewhat struggling to find the way to do that, which I guess I wonder if it actually takes us longer because maybe we do have more integrated relationships. It's less easy to be flight of foot and nimble at responding to these moments or sort of pivot your position slightly. It's in a way, it kind of mirrors the kind of military dynamics that we've been talking about, where there is an insurgency component, that there's the smaller party can fight the conflict differently because of technology. And I wonder if actually the way the broader game's playing out reflects that somewhat.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting observation, actually, because what it requires nations like Australia to do with respect to the Pacific, for example, is to figure out what sort of power it does have, because it doesn't have the economic heft of the United States or China. It can't throw as much money at them. It certainly doesn't have the same military sort of power. So what does it have? I think we're starting to see examples of that, right? Offering citizenship to people in island nations that are threatened with extinction through climate change, effectively. That's a form of leveraging soft power because Australian citizenship is valuable. It's setting up an NRL team in PNG, for example, Hamish, like a big geopolitical move that often gets missed in the sports pages when we're talking about. Like it's that sort of leveraging that I think Australia is going to have to try to reach for here. In those sort of countries, it works more successfully, much harder to do in a place like the Solomons, which is, I think, why that's been such a theatre for this sort of stuff.
Okay, well, should we do some feedback then?
All right. I think we should. People write to us. We should probably honour their efforts, shall we? I'm going to start with an email that came in from Andrew. It was a lengthy email, Hamish. It would take up the whole show to read, so I can't do that. But I'll just read the first bit because I think it captures neatly what he wants to say. This is about China. He says, I interpret China's military hardware displays not as signs of expansionism, but as a clear message to a confrontational United States. If you block shipping lanes, oil flows, or trade routes to and from China, think twice. We will defend ourselves. China has shown no credible signs of territorial expansion. The US has. I read the New York Times daily and listen to the same respected, quote-unquote, American thinkers you likely do. What I hear is a chorus of ignorance, aggression, and hyper-suspicion toward China, a strategic narrative that's more reflex than reason.
Yeah, I got to say, when I was in the States, it did surprise me the level of, I guess, kind of antagonistic rhetoric towards China that I, at that time, and this is a decade ago now, that I hadn't actually encountered quite so profoundly in Australia. So I think it is a distinction that we can make. And beyond the substance of it, I just want to pay tribute to Andrew for the use of bullet points,
yes,
the segmentation of his email into three parts involving strategic.
Excellent.
And yeah, very impressive
stuff.
Lacked
a table
so
of contents, I thought, Hamish. But apart from that, it was excellent.
You see, if you were starting under Waleed Ali, that's the sort of feedback you'd be getting. We also received this from Shane on our Indonesia Rising series. He says, I've been really enjoying the Indonesia series, and it got me thinking about Australia's future, being close neighbours with the future fourth largest world economy. And from a financial, geopolitical and security standpoint, I found myself asking the question, would it not serve Australia well to increase our investment in Indonesia's economy, both directly and indirectly, through increased trade? Surely increasing our country's investments in such a rapidly growing economy and our next door neighbour would not only build a richer Australia, but also possibly open the door for future geopolitical influence. And after all, with one of our next door neighbours growing and changing so rapidly, Australia needs this growth to be in a positive direction in order for them to grow into a country which we then want to live next door to. Yeah, we're actually going to explore that further, Shane, in the next episode. You're going to meet Willy Sabanda, who basically is advocating exactly that. He built Jakarta's metro. He's a big advocate for a closer economic relationship between the two countries, but says there is a trust issue, if we're going to be honest about it. So that's coming up next Monday. Thanks to our producers, Kylie Gray and Jesse Kay. Waleed, it's great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.